Leaders Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my co-host is on the other end of the line, Caroline Kilbourne. Hi, Mom.
Hi. I think we're living in Florida instead of Iowa.
Oh, I know. What's the temperature there on this February day?
Well, I don't have my watch on, so I can't tell you. But wait a minute. Let's see.
Warm.
It's warm. It's very warm. It's very strange. It's very strange.
Yeah, and yeah. I believe our guest today is also from somewhere where it would normally be cold in February.
Yes, I'm outside Chicago, and yesterday we hit 61 degrees, and it was glorious. It was great to take my dog for a walk, etc. But it does feel strange. The flowers are popping up, which is delightful to see. But I'm sure some cold wind is going to send them back into the ground.
Oh yeah. We're not clear yet. But
exactly.
So Caroline, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Yes, I do. Catherine Ray, and she is a national best-selling and award-winning author who has enjoyed a lifelong affair with books. She publishes both fiction and nonfiction, holds a BA and an MS from Northwestern University, and currently lives outside Chicago with her husband and three children. And this book is quite interesting. I'll let her tell you about it. Okay.
So, Catherine, first of all, welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you.
How many novels have you published?
Okay, this is terrible. I think this is number 11.
Wow.
Well, it's number 10 of novels because one is a nonfiction book. That is true.
Okay.
They listed them in your book there, and this would be 11. Yes.
And now it seems like looking at the titles of your past books. Mm-hmm. That a lot of them were sort of based on some writers from the past, Jane Austen, the Brontes, possibly.
So my first seven novels are contemporary. They are not historical fiction like my last three novels. And you are right. They are love letters to books, and they are primarily love letters to like Jane Austen and the Brontes. They're not, I have to kind of warn readers, though. They're not retellings of those stories. For instance, Dear Mr. Knightley, you would think would be a retelling of Emma. But instead, it's about a young woman who grows up in the Chicago foster care system. And she has a traumatic childhood. And her self-defense mechanism is to hide behind the personas of literary characters. So she is more likely to give you Charlotte Lucas's words than she is her own. And the story is about how she has to lay down that fiction to find her own voice. And once she can do that, then she can let love and friendship and trust and family into her life. But until she can do that, find her own voice, she's a little bit trapped in the words of others.
Oh, wow.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
So. Yeah. At what point did you decide to move from kind of that style contemporary novel with a lot of references to historical literature to actual historical novels?
Well, it started with the Printed Letter Bookshop, which is a really fun story about three women coming together to save an independent bookstore. And there are tons of literary references in that. I got to list them all in the back, and I think I cite 68 different books. But the point is, underneath all the fun of trying to save that bookstore and the mishaps and the mayhem and the misunderstandings, it's about three women who are not living in the present well. And what I discovered in writing that story is how, whether these women were aware of it or not, their pasts were indelibly imprinting upon them. And so that's when I struck out to historical fiction with the London House. I wanted to present a past event that the modern day, it's a split time story, that the modern day heroine doesn't know the truth about. And yet that event from the early days of World War II has shadowed her family for 80 years. So it's a little bit of a mystery, a little bit of a discovery, but it brings that past to life, both for the reader, because it's accessible through diary entries and letters, and to the modern day heroine. So the reader and the heroine are approaching it at the same time. And that was my dip into historical fiction.
And the Berlin Letters, which is the book that we're talking about today, we should mention that. That's the Berlin Letters.
Yes.
has sort of a similar setting in a way, although the heroine is not contemporary to us now.
Right.
She's contemporary to us 40 years ago.
A few years ago.
Yeah, 30, 40 years ago.
That's right. Yeah, the Berlin letter starts the day the wall goes up. That's August 13th, 1961. And the action, as you say, primarily takes place in that final week of the Berlin Wall, November 3rd to November 9th. And it ends that night in 1989.
This is, did you know much about the history of the Berlin Wall before you started writing this book?
A little bit. When I was researching my previous novel, I was focused on sort of the Cold War. And obviously the Berlin Wall is a huge, you know, part of that, an iconic symbol of that. So I dipped a little bit into it, and I was just intrigued by how its very structure defined the Cold War. And so I started to do more research. And then while writing it, I got to spend 6 days in Berlin. I'd never been to the city before. It was an unbelievable trip. It was amazing. So I did not have a deep dive or a deep knowledge prior to beginning the story, no.
Well, I'm actually planning a trip to Berlin probably in the fall, possibly late spring, but more likely fall. So you'll have to give me some hints on what's not to miss in Berlin.
There's so much not to miss.
It sounds like an incredible city, really. And the thing is, I'm old enough certainly to remember the fall of the Berlin Wall and how exciting it was. Even, you know, I remember sitting in our living room in a little, you know, out in the country in the middle of Iowa and hearing on the news about the wall coming down. And it was just like, symbolically for us, it was a huge thing. But for the people of Berlin, your book really brings to life what a big deal it was.
It was unfathomable in many ways, because in January of 1989, the head of state of East Germany had said, like, basically, I'm riffing on his quote, you know, the Berlin Wall will stand for 50 more years, for 100 more years, as long as it's needed. And while protests were rising up in these sort of what we'd called velvet revolutions all throughout Europe in the fall of 89, no one expected this to happen. It was mind-boggling. It was truly, you know, unprecedented.
And I did not realize, and I'm assuming that this is historically accurate, and I'm assuming that it's not, I'm not like giving anything away if it's part of history, but I didn't realize it was almost accidental that the wall opened up.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely true. What was happening is the East German government was going to loosen restrictions to allow people to apply for documentation to leave for up to a month. So they were opening, and they were being forced to open restrictions, but it was not meant to be announced that evening as if immediate, and it was not meant to be unrestricted access. Documentations were still going to have to be required, but and I can't remember his name at the moment, I'm drawing a blank, but he had not read the press release prior to that moment. And then an Italian reporter said, well, wait, are you serious? And he goes, well, yes, it's right here and it's immediate. And so all of a sudden people started flooding to the gates and the guards did not have any authorization. They had no idea what was going on, but thousands and thousands and thousands of people came to the barricades, the gates, and at 11 o'clock, the first one opened.
So it was a member of the Politburo?
Yes, yeah, it was.
So he read this press release. Was the press release miswritten, or did he misread it?
No, he misread it. It was a press release that you that the next day things were to open up and you could go to your local government office and apply for paperwork to leave the country on a much less restricted basis. So it was sort of misread. And then when he was asked, well, when does this take effect? There was no timing on it. And he said immediately.
So what happened to that guy?
I have no idea. I need to look that up.
Whoa.
I mean, he was in the press everywhere. And you can, on YouTube, you can look up this press conference and you can see his confusion as he's reading. And you can hear the Italian reporter say, please clarify this. So, I mean, it's all out there because, you know, unlike, you know, much earlier in history, we now have recordings of all of this stuff. And so you can see his consternation and his confusion.
Wow. So, Catherine, you decided you wanted to set a book around the rise and fall of the Berlin Wall. Mm-hmm. Where did you go from there? To your final project. How did you get from that concept to this story?
Well, there were two things that came simultaneously. Well, number one was the Berlin Wall, both as a character within the story and as the structure of the story. But the second was the Venona Project. And that was a top secret CIA code breaking project that started in 1943 and it ran all the way to 1980. And when I read about this project, which was conducted primarily by women amazing at math, who are breaking Soviet codes all those years, I thought to myself, what if that didn't stop in 1980? What if some CIA officer decided that there was more information to be gleaned from those old codes? And so that set up the idea of a code breaker. And the code breaker, Louisa Vogler, in my story, is working as part of Venona 2, and she stumbles across a code that reminds her of a childhood memory and sends us back to her story. And it becomes really a family love story of a bunch of spies, a bunch of codes, one side of the Berlin Wall and the other, and all that good stuff.
Wow. Now, do you know German? Do you speak German?
I do not. There was a section of the book I was going to read for you today. And I was like, wait a minute, there's too much German in here and I will stumble over all of the pronunciations.
Yeah, it seems like a difficult language to learn. I studied German briefly when I was in ninth grade, we lived in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Well, Lancaster is settled, you know, there's still a lot of German speakers there. And so German was one of the languages offered in school, and I started that. And then in the middle of ninth grade, we moved to Iowa, and they didn't offer German. So I can count to 10.
That's more than I can do.
But, yeah, that's about it.
How did they build the wall? I know they started with you know, just wires, first of all, on this. But then what did they build it with?
So it was really quite remarkable. Walter Ulbricht, the head of state of East Germany, had wanted this barricade because you have to remember from 1945 until 1961, 2.6 million people fled East Germany. I mean, it was decimating the population, the fleeing, and the economy. And so he kept asking Moscow, can I build a wall? Can I build a wall? And they kept saying, no, you may not build a wall. And then he got the green light. And he had been secretly purchasing and stockpiling barbed wire and creating prefabricated cement blocks sort of off-site. And when he got the yes, Operation Rose, and that's what it was called, was begun on the night Saturday, August 12th. And by 6 a.m. the next morning, he had surrounded. We think about the wall as blocking East Berlin, but it didn't. It actually surrounded West Berlin. Because if you think about it, all of Berlin sat within East Germany or the Soviet sector as it became in 1945 after the Yalta Agreement. So anyway, so it surrounded West Berlin. And so East Berlin was cut off within that morning. I think it's something like 193 streets from east to west were blocked, 68 border crossings, and 12 train stations, and phone lines were also cut. So you're right, on that first morning, it was coiled barbed wire. But within days, Ulbricht moved in the cement blocks. And then within days of that, he started emptying the apartments that abutted the wall and were really close to the wall. And he started creating what became, on the eastern side, called the buffer zone. We often call it the death strip. Because the wall, the wall isn't one thing. We think of it in 1989 as that big 10-foot structure. But behind, on the east side of that 10-foot structure, was a buffer zone filled with sand and metal shards and guard posts. And then there was a littler wall, about 6 feet high, at the other side of the buffer zone. So between where East German could go and the actual wall on the west side was about, 100 to 600 feet of sort of no man's land buffer zone.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow.
I know.
Were people able to successfully escape through that, or was it completely impossible?
And not completely impossible. On that first day, reports have about 800 getting through, and there are pictures. You can Google, images of the day the wall went up. And there's one which two photos really looks like a mother handed her child over the wall
barbed wire.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that also played a role in my story. And there's another very famous picture of a soldier, a Volkspolizei, an East German soldier, jumping over the barbed wire. And there are also lots of stories about different soldiers in those first few days just dropping the trowel they're working on to build the cement and hopping over. But that said, that went down really quickly. Within a couple weeks, that 800 was almost zero because a shoot-to-kill order went into effect, I believe, on August 24th. So just, 2 weeks later. And then they started coiling barbed wire when they didn't need it anymore because of the cement. They started coiling it in the River Spree, which was another way people were getting over. So they cut down all the different
ways. Oh,
yeah.
If you have to put up a wall and shoot to keep your people in, maybe that's a hint you're doing something wrong.
You think?
What? One thing?
Wow. Now, up until that point, though, people in East Berlin could move into West Berlin.
They could. See, that was the issue. You see, as I said, Berlin itself was fully inside, 100 miles inside East Germany from West Germany. And the border between East Germany and West Germany was absolutely closed. So if you were an East German and you wanted to get out, you simply went to East Berlin, which was the Soviet sector, and you walked across the street. Because part of the Yalta Agreement said that Berlin had to be open. Even though it was divided into four sections, and the West became those sections that were controlled by the United States, France, and Great Britain, even though they were separate there, the Yalta Agreement said free passage between all the sections. So people would go to East Berlin, and they would walk across the street, and then they would fly out of West Berlin and be gone. So what happened was, even in July, the month prior to the wall going up, 20,000 people left through East Berlin. It was an escape hatch that Ulbricht felt he had to close.
How did they close? I mean, the rest of the border between East Germany and West Germany would be much bigger. How in the world were they able to keep that closed?
Well, lots of guard towers, again, barbed wire. I'm not even sure all the different ways, but it was just easier because that wasn't against an agreement. The closing of the city was,
right.
Technically, the West could have had something very strong to say about that because it violated the Yalta Agreement. However, they didn't. They determined it was not worth going to war over.
Wow. Now, later, there's something that where the West really does make a difference, but almost accidentally. Do you want to describe and why you incorporate how you incorporated that into this story?
Are you talking about solidarity and Poland?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so this is a story I came across in Paul Kruger's book, and it's called A Pope and a President, and it's an amazing book about the history of this time in the 1980s. And he tells this story from an NSA, and it's an unnamed NSA employee, but logically it makes great sense to me. If you think about the fact that in 1956 and in 1968, the USSR had no qualms about moving into Hungary and into Czechoslovakia for both the Hungarian Revolution and the Prague Spring, you do kind of wonder, why did they not move in on Poland in 1981 against Solidarity? Because that was really rising up and getting to be quite dramatic and quite a threat. And so this book talked about, there was a series of Soviet military exercises right at the Polish border. And they were building up and they kept saying to the world, these are just military exercises. But they were going on and on, 3 weeks longer than their stated end date. And it was getting people a little nervous, but they kept saying, military exercises, military exercises. And then this NSA official, we were listening to chatter, and it sounded like that the Soviets were going to go into Poland. But then one night, the chatter stops, and the Soviets back off, done. I mean, just vanished. The whole thing vanished without a word. And so when they put the dots together, they realized that was the day U.S. President Reagan had the assassination attempt against his life. Now, they are not related, but what happened was the U.S. went on military high alert, which is exactly what happens when there's assassination attempt. So our missile silos were open. We were ready for attack because we didn't know what we were dealing with. And the thought is that the Soviets did not want to sort of push the buttons of an America that was ready for war, instantaneously ready for war, even if it had nothing to do with them. So crazy story, which makes logical sense. And the nice thing is, whether it can be proven or not, I put it in a fictional story, but it is in Paul Kruger's book, and it makes such logical sense. I found it absolutely fascinating. And you also have to remember that that's the time that Alexander Haig stood in the White House and said, I am in charge. And what he meant was, at this moment in this White House, I'm in charge. He did not mean I'm in charge of the whole U.S. government, but if you're a Soviet and you hear that a general is saying that, you might think twice about, you know, an aggressive move that's going to call all the world's attention to you.
Yeah, for sure. And how much did Pope John Paul have to do, do you think, with this whole fall of the wall and the rise of the freedom of Eastern Europe, basically.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I don't think we in the West can understand how integral he was. I do know from reading documents that the day he was made Pope, Moscow was terrified. He was from Poland. He was anti-communist. He had the people's hearts already. They were terrified of him. And I just don't think we can quite understand the influence he had over there and the hope that he gave Eastern Europe at that time, especially being a Polish pope. I cannot overestimate his influence after doing the research.
The other thing that I've always wondered about is, without Gorbachev there, none of this might have happened. What was it that inspired him to sort of, I mean, some people, if you think that the Soviet Union was a good thing and that, you know, Russian Empire is a good thing, you would think Gorbachev was a traitor in a way, you know, that he let it all go.
Right.
Why? Why did he do that?
You know, many, many hardliners in the Soviet Union absolutely determined he was. They thought he was. Why do I think he did? I'm not entirely sure. There's sort of conflicting accounts. There's even some supposition. Was Gorbachev a closet? You know, did he have faith? I don't know the answers to those questions. I do know that from all sides, sort of those bells of freedom were ringing. There were just increasingly rising up. I mean, the numbers of protests all across Eastern Europe and in Germany, in East Germany, you've got, you know, 700,000 in Leipzig. You've got, you know, borders opening between Austria and Hungary. I think there was so much pressure. And I also think that, you know, at the time, the Soviet Union really was falling apart. In the early 1980s, there were so many embargoes against them when they invaded Afghanistan in the end of 1979, December of 79. There were so many embargoes against them. The economy was collapsing. Whether or not those suppositions that Gorbachev had some faith are true or not, I think he could look around and say, this model isn't working. And I have to release some control or it will be wrenched from me. It's much better to give up control than have it seized from you, I would think.
Yeah.
So those are just some of my thoughts on that. But there are a lot of, you know, swirling ideas about who he really was and what he deeply held. I don't know.
And I don't know what happened to him.
Not entirely sure I know what happened to him. I think I'm going to have to look that up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny. When you're focused on a book, my focus was so primary to end on November 9th, 1989, because if I looked forward into 91, say when Germany was unified or when the Soviet Union fell, it would color what happened before. I would be projecting. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be honest with you. When researching this story, I made sure that I didn't read anything, pretty much anything post-1989, because I didn't want to look back and say, wait till these freedoms happen. Nobody in 1989 could have anticipated those freedoms happening.
Right.
So I had to be really careful. And so, yeah, there are some gaps in my knowledge now.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Catherine Ray, author of The Berlin Letters. Would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. Okay, so I thought about this a great deal about what I would read for you. You know, would I read the very beginning, and I'm not giving anything away, when Luisa's mother passes her over the wall. Or there's a wonderful scene when Luisa dresses punk, which I had so much fun with. But I'm going to think you...
That was interesting.
I had so much fun with that. But I'm going to read you a little chapter where Luisa decides that she actually needs to break all the rules and head to East Germany. So here is chapter 13 from Luisa's point of view. Washington, D.C., Monday, November 6, 1989. As I leave the Washington Post building, I glance at my watch, 4 o'clock. I can't go home, and I can't go back to the office. I find myself driving around to kill time, then realize it's too much time to kill driving. A sign for the fabulous bakery catches my eyes, and I'm reminded of Carrie's comment this morning about Michelle Pfeiffer. I turn into the cinema parking lot and decide to catch her newest film, but it's already started. I'm left with the choice between John Travolta's romantic comedy, Look Who's Talking, or the Shakespearean drama Henry V, starring Kenneth Branagh. War, intrigue, blood, and death feel more up my alley tonight. With dinner in hand, a large bucket of popcorn and a Sprite, I settle in for the show, ready to let my weekend, the letters, Oma, Opa, Alice, and Bran Porter go. And I do, quite successfully, until Branagh makes me pick everything up again. I'm not sure what I expected. I never read Henry V in school. While I didn't expect a romp like A Midsummer Night's Dream or As You Like It, which I did read in 10th grade, I certainly didn't expect such a violent battle, or such a powerful call to courage, to brotherhood, to arms, and to a virtuous fight. I didn't expect his rousing St. Crispin Day speech to put me on the edge of my seat, my heart expanding as I eagerly digested every word. I certainly didn't expect a movie to ignite a lightning bolt of conviction that tells me no matter the struggle, no matter the cost, I need to get my father out of that Stasi jail. What? The credits roll and I'm left staring at the black screen with the magnitude of this realization weighing within me. A shuffling teenager with a broom finally asks me to leave. I gather my trash, swipe my eyes, then drop into my chair again. I had no idea I was crying. But I was. I am. I sit ashamed at how I've been internalizing these letters, as if it was all directed at me, for me, and yet they were kept from me. None of it was about me, or not just about me. Opa and my father, even my mother when she told Harris Opa's secret, Oma and Alice, Bran Porter, they are all part of a much larger story than how it affected one small girl growing up, one woman with a host of questions now. And my father is in prison. A Stasi prison. How have I been living with that thought and not viscerally registering its horror? I drive home with endless plans cycling through my brain, harebrained schemes that have no hope of working because I have no idea how to put them into action. My mind dashes back to my few months at the farm, and while much of what we learned was about honing instincts and acumen, a great deal was about planning and preparation. I need to slow down, assess my assets and liabilities. I need to find allies. At the very least, I need to get myself to West Berlin fast. From there, who knows? I pull into the driveway. Oma has left the light above the back stairs on, and I note she has finally planted her peas and oats. The raised garden beds no longer churned, but padded smooth. Dark lines show where she has watered. I open the back door slowly so it won't squeak and walk with careful steps to the refrigerator. The popcorn wasn't enough, and my stomach demands real food. My heart softens at the sight of a full dinner on the second shelf, a steak, a sweet potato, broccoli. I pull out the food and wish we had a microwave oven, but they're expensive, and Oma doesn't trust anything that cooks food in less than a few hours. Rather than turn off the oven and wait, I sit at the table, remove the plastic wrap on the dinner, and dig into it cold. That's when I notice the hall light is still on. It's our signal for me to check the pad by the telephone. It means I've missed a call. Call Bran Porter. Next to his name, she's written both his number and a question mark. I smile. She is not questioning if she got the number right. She is asking if he's a prospective suitor or a, quote, nice young man I should consider dating, as if that's what's keeping me from dating. I'm too picky. That answers one question, however. Oma does not know Bran Porter. I lift the handset off the cradle and stretch the 20-foot cord into the kitchen. It comfortably reaches the table, which is why I bought the cord for Oma last year. She never tells anyone who calls that she's in the middle of lunch or dinner or a cup of tea. Until this long course, she simply stood in the hallway, listening to whoever called her, letting life in the kitchen grow cold. Porter speaking. Hi, Mr. Porter. It's Louisa. I pause, unsure what to say next. I'm sorry to call you tonight, but this couldn't wait until lunch. He, too, pauses, and I almost interrupt, but he starts up before I can. I called my contact at the CIA. He wants to meet you tomorrow morning at Langley, 8 a.m., have you ever been there? Yes, I can find it. Good. Go to the main entrance and ask for, do you need a pen? Oh. I jump from the chair and step into the hallway where Oma and I keep a small pad of paper and a jar of pens and pencils. I'm ready. Great. 8 a.m. Ask for Andrew Cademan. C-A-D-E-M-A-N. You got that? Cademan. And here's his number. Something comes up and you have any troubles. I'm frozen. I can't think. I can't write. I can't speak. He recites the numbers, but I don't hear a digit. I don't need to. I know my own boss's number by heart.
Thank you. And that was Catherine Ray reading from the Berlin Letters. Wow.
There we go.
Yeah. You mentioned that one of the chapters you thought about reading is when Louisa dresses up as punk.
Yes.
So
yeah, let's talk about the punk. That was really interesting. That really was.
It was fascinating for me too, to be honest.
So were the punk musicians really leaders in the opposition, essentially?
Yes, and meaning, you know, they weren't high level, but they were a thorn. The Stasi had hundreds of agents tracking these kids. And I say kids because I'm old enough. Way older than probably their mothers were. we're talking teenagers into early 20s. Some may have been older, but very young, very young. And they were thwarting the establishment at every point. Basically, from the way they dressed, they were saying, you know, you cannot choose my future for me in any aspect, and I'm willing to accept the consequences of not living by your rules. And that is very different from punk in the West. Punk in the West may have been, you know, maybe I'm bored, or I'm against this, or I don't like this sort of statements. Whereas in the East, it was, I defy you, and I'm willing to pay the cost, because there was a cost. The stories of these kids being hauled off to Stasi prisons and body cavity searches and interrogations and just the horrific things they went through to continually defy the establishment, the government, the regime, was absolutely incredible. It was incredible. So, yes, they were a part of it. And a lot of them also were a part of these underground churches and these big movements. Because one way they passed information back and forth was to go to other countries and go to different punk concerts. So they would learn what's going on in Hungary, what's going on in Romania, and they would bring that information back. And they would write it in these secret underground newspapers, and they would disseminate those papers across the country, letting people know what was going on in a way that, you know, the spies really couldn't catch on to, because who is going to mix and mash in the middle of a teenage punk concert? It was an incredible way to bring across information and to keep poking at the government. So, yes, they were.
And these underground churches, were they in actual church buildings?
They were, because the churches in the early days, you know, 1945 on, and the Protestant churches did it better than the Catholic churches. And I talk about that in the book, too. But they were given legal autonomy. And so they sort of held on to that. Now, yes, you could have, you know, Stasi in there on a weekend monitoring your sermons and calculating who was there. But on the whole, they weren't to really mess with the churches. And so during the weeks, oftentimes in the basement, these groups met and they printed out these secret papers and they talked about plans of protests and revolts and things like that. So the churches were a huge part of it.
So let's talk about the Stasi, and what does Stasi stand for? What does it mean? And
you're going to get my, aren't you? Okay. Oh, Stasi is short, and it's a Ministerium der Staffen, you know, it's a whole long German name. And if I had my notebook right in front of me, but Stasi is short for that. It's just a tiny bit of its third name. I mean, like the KGB stands for something super long, you know, as well. And so the Stasi is just the nickname for the state security. Now, the thing about the state security, it is absolutely not the police to protect the people. It is, that would be the Volkspolizei or the Vopo. That would be the police. However, the Stasi is the state security to protect the state. So that can be even against its own people. You have to remember what the Stasi's function is, and that is first and foremost to protect the state from any threat. And so the Stasi were masters at gaining information, organizing it, culling it, keeping it, using it. And they had, let's see, I'm thinking in the 1980s, they had about 250,000 officers, but they had 1.5 million informants. And they were called Spetzels in German, or snitches. And that is about 1 in every 8 citizens. So if you think about that, if you live in an apartment, you've probably got several snitches on your floor. You might have them in your friend group. You might have them in your family. And in the book, I really utilize that a bit. Because if you think about it, if you are in an alternative scene like punk, I promise you that number was way higher than 1 in 8, because they wanted to know what was going on in the punk scene. And they got to you in different ways. You know, the Stasi could promise you an easier life, or your kids an easier life, or they could threaten you with demotion. The Stasi was also brilliant at something called decomposition. And it sounds like something that would happen to one once they got into jail, but it actually happened on the outside of jail, where they would just systematically transform aspects of your life until you basically crumbled. For instance, you'd be blamed for something at work you didn't do. A friend would turn on you. Something would disappear so that you thought you were going crazy. and to the point you would almost agree to anything to get your mind back.
That, you know, turning citizens against one another seemed to have been something that the communist countries were really good at. And yeah. we did an interview with Ruta Sepetys a couple years ago on her book, I Must Betray You, which was basically about that in Romania, about, and you didn't know who, and you had to suspect everybody. And it's like, you know, how effective, that is so effective. And yet, in a way, the people would have had the power too, because they could have all decided, no, we're not cooperating with this and we're going to give you bad. I'm sure some of the informants misinformed, you know, didn't give
I'm
actual.
I'm sure they did. At great peril. I mean, seriously, like, and I'm certainly not justifying it, but in the book I do explore the fear of it.
Yeah.
It is when you feel very alone and they're coming after you and your family, you can feel you have no way out. It takes great courage to take that way out, which is what Harris does and which is what a lot of the punks do and many people do. It's what Manfred in the book really does.
Now, you have a couple of characters. Harris is Luisa's father and mm-hmm. Manfred also, who, at least in Harris's case, he was a true believer in communism and socialism until he wasn't.
Exactly. Until he wasn't.
Yeah. And do you think that was common, that there were people early in the time of the Soviet occupation who thought this could be a good thing?
I do. I do. I mean, if you think about the promises of everybody will live this equal life and everyone will be employed and the economy will hum along and your needs will be taken care of, all of that probably felt like, wow, we as a human people are entering the next level of utopia. But in effect, that's not true. But it takes a long time, and it took Harris a little time to figure out what that really meant, that it was not true, and the strictures and the controls and the sort of, you know, the wizard behind the curtain or whatever, just to see through that.
And wouldn't it be nice if it actually were true, if there were a way that everybody could be treated well and fairly and everybody have enough and
it would be wonderful. Communism is not the way to get there.
Yeah. So I didn't know that the wall went up in 1961 because I would have been very small then. And so for me, it was just always there. So I, I figured it was like from the end of World War II, it was there. So it was interesting to learn that. But Mom, Caroline, I'm wondering, do you remember the wall going up?
Well, I do, but I the thing is, it's interesting to me, the German people had just emerged from Nazism and then this, and I would think they would have just been overwhelmed with all of this. I mean, that's the feeling that I have, so I must have felt that way then too. You know, how can this happen? You know, they just, oh gosh, I don't know. I don't really remember reading about it very much. I don't know that it was in our, in our news that much.
Interesting. Yeah.
Of course, I was busy raising a family, and so I don't know.
Right.
I even watched it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And when the wall went down, it didn't really take very long for the German people to reunify, did it?
No, that happened in 1991.
Yeah.
But there, there were discussions very early on and what that would look like. I mean, when Yalta happened in 1945, it was never meant to be a over four decade
occupation.
Yeah. But that's right. But that's what it became. And so, yes, it did take a little time to figure out how to reunify Germany, et cetera. But you're right. Those discussions started to happen very soon after the wall came down.
Yeah. So, Catherine, let's talk a little bit about your journey as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
How, like your first book, did the first book you ever wrote get published, or do you have some still sitting in the drawer?
The first book I ever wrote got published, which was amazing, an amazing experience. And it sold within a multi-book contract. And so I had to learn how to do that job for real, quick.
Oh, wow. So what were you doing before that?
I was doing marketing. I had worked in nonprofit development for a few years. And then my family went through what I call the great years of moving. We moved within a 14-year time period. We moved our children from Chicago to Austin, Texas, to London, England, to Dublin, Ireland, back to Austin, Texas, to Seattle, Washington. And so
why?
I have three kids. I don't ask the question. My husband's job moved just quite a bit. And so I had three kids. So I would do part-time sort of marketing work and volunteer work, et cetera, when we were moving so much. But I was basically doing marketing. And then I started to write that first book, which became Dear Mr. Knightley.
And what inspired you to write that? Had you always wanted to be a writer, or just you loved reading and decided, hey, I could do this?
Well, I do love reading. I always wanted to be a writer, but oddly, I always thought I would be a nonfiction writer. I always thought I'd be a college professor. But anyway, so when this story came to me, I mean, it was so clearly fiction. It just captured my interest, and I started writing it. And to be honest, I love, love, love writing fiction. I may write another nonfiction book someday, but I'm not entirely committed to that premise. I really adore my career in writing novels.
I bet. So you got a multi-book contract right out of the gate. That's pretty rare.
It was very nice. Yeah. It was very nice.
Now, did you have an agent that you were working with?
I did.
And how did you find your agent? Because, you know, people always say in a way, that's the hard part, is getting the agent.
Okay, I love this story, and it's going to take me a minute to tell it, but no one can replicate this story, so I'm going to say I'm very sorry. When I was dreaming up Dear Mr. Knightley, I went to a writer's conference, and I will say right then and there, if you can get yourself, aspiring published authors to a writer's conference, it is a great way to meet editors, to meet publishers, sort of get that little bit of face-to-face that you absolutely cannot get otherwise. So anyway, I did meet a small publisher at that conference, and she said to me, hey, this is a great story. If you ever write it, and most people don't, if you ever write it, I'd love to see it. So I wrote it, and I queried 41 agents, and I got 37 rejections because 4 didn't even bother to write me back. And then I know. And then I sent it to her off the cuff. And she wrote back, I want to buy this. Now I'm going to tell you, it was the worst offer ever. There was no money behind it. It was ebook only. It was very sad. But the same day that offer came into my mailbox came sort of the newsletter promoting the next year's writers conference, and my picture was in the center of Ask the Editor a Question, and that picture was simply me talking to someone, a random galley shot, no attribution. They had no idea who it was, but it was me, and the question was, do I need an agent? So I was like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. So I went to I wrote the head of the writers group, the organizer, and I said, oh my goodness, my picture is here. This is my question. And he wrote back and he said, well, of course you need an agent, but if you've got an offer, because of course I didn't tell him what the offer was, if you've got an offer, no agent will turn you down. Just call up an agent. So I was like, oh, well, that's not going to work. So what I did is I went to my bookshelves and I pulled down 10 books that I thought Dear Mr. Knightley, as was my working title, Dear Mr. Knightley would sit next to, well, if you liked this, you'd like this, you know, comp titles. And three were by the same agency. And I went on their website and I saw a photograph and I was like, oh my goodness, that's my agent. I just feel it. So I called him up, which you're never supposed to do. And he called me back, which was hilarious because I couldn't answer any of his questions. He said, what's your elevator pitch? And my response was, what is an elevator pitch? I mean, it was a disastrous phone call. And at the end of it, he said, I cannot take you on. However, if you send me the manuscript, you send me the offer, I will glance over everything and I'll just give you some advice. I was like, fair enough. Thank you very much. And the next week he called back and he said, forget that. I want to represent you. And so that's how I found my first agent. Crazy.
Wow.
I will say this. Unfortunately, he passed away a year later. So he is no longer my agent. But I still regard him as the world's best agent.
Oh, that's
a great story.
Really, I know, it's a great story, but it can't be replicated.
No. But in the end, what it means is that the writing wins. If you have a really good, well-written story, you will find an agent.
Yeah. You will find an agent. And here's the thing. The writing wins and perseverance wins. Mm. Don't let 41 rejections. That's a big number. Don't let that stop you. My feeling about writing and about the publishing journey is you cannot control the end. You can only control the journey and how you act on the journey. So keep your hopes up, keep your head high, enjoy the gift you've been given to write, and keep going.
Mm.
There you go.
That's a great quote.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah. What is your writing process like? Are you a pantser or a plotter?
Yeah, I'm a hybrid. I'm a little bit of both. I will get the sort of real aerial view structure of the story. I almost liken it to a skeleton. You know, I'll get the head, the shoulders, the hips, the knees, the feet, basic outline. And then I change the whole analogy and I liken it to running the tide up a beach. And I'll start at the beginning and I'll run that tide up the wave as far as I can until I lose the threads, and then I'll go back and then I'll start again. So by the time I hand in a manuscript, that first portion is really fairly clean. I might have gone through that 6-7 times, but the final scene may have only seen 2 edits or revisions.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Okay. So do you write chronologically?
I do. Sometimes I break that because I will have this incredible emotion that I know fits the last scene. And so I'll sort of try to dash down and capture what that emotion is when I get to it. But one of the reasons I really want to force myself to stay chronological is that emotion builds. If you write a book out of chronological order, you are depleting that sort of synergistic emotion building that is created within a story, because you're bringing different emotions on different days. You really have to remember your character is moving through this story as if it's life, and life builds upon the moment before.
Wow. You're just full of great quotes for writers. Now, in the Berlin Letters, you had multiple timelines and multiple perspectives. So how did you move among those?
Mm. I wrote those, I want to say chronologically as well. And I don't mean chronologically according to Harris's timeline, in the sense that he skips years. He's only got about 5 chapters and he covers the entire era of the Berlin Wall. But I did everything to Louisa's emotional timeline. And if you look at when Harris has a chapter, you will see that it is playing on an emotion that Louisa is dealing with at that time. So the emotional impact he is going through actually adds to hers. So she is the emotional directive of the story, and I wrote them together so that he plays into that emotion and parallels her and augments her.
Oh, you really put a lot of thought into this.
I do. I do. I put a lot of, you know, to be honest, I put a lot of thought into all that sub-themery, all the meta-themes, wow, even more so than I put into the action. Because I think, you know, the action's really interesting, but it's all that emotion and all that conflict that's beneath the surface that will leave the reader past the last page going, oof, I can't let that character go. Mm. There's something telling about her that I am still emotionally hanging on to. And it's really what we writers want.
Well, this character could go into future stories.
She could. Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Isn't she going off to an interesting future?
Yeah. So is that, yeah, is that in the works? Is that in the back of your mind somewhere?
You know, it's always back. I think it's always in the back of any writer's mind. The idea that a character could be so compelling that he or she could become a series, that's great stuff. I think a publisher would have to say, hey, we have seen such an incredible response to this story. Go back to Louisa and let's see more of her. Mm. Right now, I've moved on to a different time period, a different heroine, a different event. But that doesn't mean I couldn't come back, because I think Daniel, a character we haven't discussed and we don't need to discuss, I find him endlessly fascinating as well. And he and Louisa obviously will have some adventures.
Yeah, of course. So in terms of your historical fiction, you went from World War II to the Cold War to the fall of the Berlin Wall. So are you going to the next phase or are you backing up?
I am not backing up. I'm going a little, well, I am backing up, but not in the same way. I am going to 1973 London, where I will take you into the world of an art forgery.
Oh.
So excited.
And of course, that means a trip to London, right?
I have been to London many times, so I think I've had my trip. I lived there for a couple of years in the early 2000s. And in the past couple of years, I think I've been back 4 or 5 times for different reasons. My daughter lived there for a bit, and so I have to visit her.
Of course, you know. Of course.
So it's a good start.
Well, we're out of time, Catherine. And Caroline, do you have some closing words for us?
Well, she had so many quotes, but this is one, because between Louisa's father and her grandfather, one should never discount the necessity or the power of a good friendship.
Mm.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And thank you for being with us today, Catherine.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I've loved this. I really, really appreciate it.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye, everyone.